Welcome to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered. This is Dr. Rusty Andrews with Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we're here today to talk about a current topic of mental health interest, as well as to answer your questions about that topic or any other involving life, living it, and relationships. You can email your questions to us at any time at answers, A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at Andrews, Inc., that's A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C, .net. So send us an email with your question at answers at andrewsinc.net. We will not use your name, and we will protect your privacy by doing that. So send us a question to answers at andrewsinc.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, and you can also check us out on Konza Internet Radio's website, and that's Konza Radio, K-O-N-Z-A radio.org. So welcome to Andrew's Answers, and today I'd like to introduce our special guest, Dr. John Fagen. Dr. Fagen is a psychologist, also at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fagen.
Good morning, Rusty.
Could you just start us out? We're going to talk a little bit about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder today, and that's been really very much in the news. But before we get on to the topic, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into being a psychologist, where you've worked, and the experiences you've had?
Well, I am a Kansas native, and I graduated from high school in 1963 with no idea of what I was going to do. Along came the draft, and I was sort of a draft dodger. I joined the Air Force instead of letting the Army take me.
And that was a safer option.
Yes, sir. I really was interested in electronics at the time, and computers were just starting to come into vogue. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way I wanted to go. But after I was in the field for a while, I incidentally took a college course, and the first one that was offered on campus was, on the Air Force base, was a psychology course. So I just enrolled in that because it was available, and immediately discovered that, no, I was not interested in working with things. I was interested in working with people.
Oh, wow.
So then I started reading and started taking more courses and decided, yes, I would become a psychologist. So after 10 years in the military, I was able to accumulate some college credits and then get out and complete my bachelor's degree and then my master's and doctorate. So I've been working in the field since 1979.
Wow, that's quite a while.
I specialized in children and families by taking extra courses and doing some extra practicum work at a children's hospital. And so my internship was also focused on children and families, and I am able to work across a broad spectrum of clients, but my first love is still children and families.
Wow, terrific. Well, so the topic of ADHD would be one that would fit right in there since it's typically diagnosed in childhood, not necessarily always, but it is a common topic among teachers in the school system and parents, and we're wondering if their kids have ADHD and what to do about it if they do, and whether or not they should use medication. So thanks for coming to talk to us about it. Let me just start out. We usually don't do it this way, but let me just start out because we have a very insightful question that's about ADHD, and I want to read it because it gets us going into the topic. And the question is, it seems, or maybe it's because we are simply more aware that more and more children are being diagnosed with ADHD. What is the evaluation process for determining this diagnosis, and what is the time frame for that to happen? And once diagnosed, what measures are explored to assist with focus and hyperactivity before medication is selected as an option for assisting with these issues? So I'd like us to talk about those things, but we don't have to directly answer that question right now. But tell us some basic things about ADHD, what it is, how it gets diagnosed, those kinds of things.
Well, ADHD, when I first learned about ADHD in graduate school, it was called minimal brain dysfunction, and it has had a variety of other labels over time. And it has more recently become part of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in a very specific way. There are two types of attention problems. One is the attention deficit disorder. The other is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
So the difference between ADD and ADHD.
Exactly. Yeah. We call ADD the daydreamers. Okay. And we call the ADHD the Daredevils.
Ah, okay.
The Daredevils are the most obvious one, and they are typically male as opposed to females. And they are often more active in the womb before birth. Oh. They are more active in their early childhood. They may walk before mm-hmm. other children do. Mm-hmm. They may not talk and focus on social activities, but they may learn to throw a ball, ride a bicycle, mm-hmm. and do all kinds of physical activities far quicker than other children.
So in some ways, they're going to look more advanced.
Initially, they can.
In infancy,
That's for sure.
Yeah. And this is not to say ADHD doesn't indicate a lack of intelligence or lower functioning necessarily.
Actually, kids with ADD or ADHD are often above average rather than below average.
Okay.
Research shows us that they tend to be bright children.
Yeah.
Not always, but often.
Yeah.
But by definition, it's a persistent pattern of inattention and or hyperactivity and impulsivity that is more frequent and more severe than other children their same age. So the hyperactivity tends to fade as children hit puberty, but the inattention and impulsivity often remain into adulthood. And in fact, 2/3 of adults who were identified with ADD or ADHD as children still have significant symptoms as they go through the stages of life.
Oh, okay.
The degree of the seriousness of the symptoms can range from very minor, very mild, mm-hmm. to very severe.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about the incidence rate or the prevalence rate of ADD and ADHD, it's really a guess because mm-hmm. there are many, many children and adults who have this problem, but it is so mild it's never diagnosed.
Okay.
So it's really, really difficult to trace the epidemiology of where does this occur most often, in what groups. What states in the United States, what countries in the world. There's a great deal of research looking at the differentiation or the variance in where it's diagnosed and how often it's diagnosed.
So there does seem to be some differences there.
Well, the differences appear on paper in numbers, but we don't really know if the differences are real.
Yeah.
Because attitudes toward accepting children's misbehavior mm-hmm. varies significantly from mm-hmm. culture to culture.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in some cultures, it's almost expected that boys will be boys.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, certainly, we certainly took a whip and straightened them out, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they were just considered spoiled or just bad boys
uh-huh.
or just ditzy girls.
Yeah.
They just weren't seen as, and still in some cultures, they're just not seen as having any kind of a neurological problem that is inherited. They're simply seen as having a moral problem or a behavior problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a variety of ways of defining children's difficulties and measuring them.
Well, now, you mentioned the difference between somebody who has sort of a minor level or a smaller level of symptoms compared to a major level, and the ones with a minor level of symptoms might not even be diagnosed, although they might qualify. What kinds of things would a person see in a child that would be sort of at the minor level?
Just frequently off task, easily distracted,
mm-hmm.
Paying more attention to noises in the hallway than to the teacher.
Kind of a lack of focus kind of a thing.
Absolutely.
Tracking
somebody who gets up to sharpen a pencil or throw away a piece of trash instead of staying focused on the textbook.
Yeah, yeah.
Deciding to read something that's more interesting than the topic that's being lectured.
Yeah, and what you're describing are things that probably describe most of us at some point in time.
That's a very good point. We may all have just a shred of this because it's very difficult to stay focused, especially if you're very bright and mm-hmm. the class is moving at a slower pace to keep up with the typical children.
Yeah.
And it's easy for a very bright person to get bored and start to have some appearance of this difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be very minor, as mm-hmm. I said, and you just correct the child, you remind the child. And they get back on task relatively quickly.
And that's all there is to it.
And that's nothing ever comes of it. And you might find some adults who still have a bit of that distractibility, a bit of that impulsivity. They tend to say the wrong thing at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. They tend to forget something here or there, pay a bill late once or twice. Mm-hmm. But it's never so much to get their water shut off, never so much to lose a job, never so much to wind up in court or mm-hmm. in divorce. Mm-hmm. So there is a wide variety.
Yeah.
Certainly, this is an inherited problem, almost exclusively. There are some traumas, some brain lesions, tumors, high fevers that can damage parts of the brain that then produce some of these symptoms. But typically, ADD or ADHD is considered a genetic illness. And if you see a child or an adult with that problem, you're going to see others in their family tree. People who are a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
Good attitudes, trying hard, maybe mm-hmm. very successful, mm-hmm. but always maybe just a little bit off track,
mm-hmm.
needing a reminder. You mm-hmm. know, they may overcompensate by carrying a planner 24 hours a day and consulting it 20 times a day to keep themselves self-regulated.
And that works well for them.
It works.
So, yeah.
And in fact, that's the sort of thing we try to teach children to learn to self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
We in schools, we can use a sort of a cognitive intervention to help them talk to themselves, that sort of internal dialogue to remind themselves frequently to stay mm-hmm. on task, pay mm-hmm. attention, mm-hmm. put your eyes on the paper, put your eyes on the teacher. Mm-hmm. And we can teach them, especially the brighter ones and the ones who aren't quite so severely hampered, we can teach them a lot of self-management or self-regulation, mm-hmm. which is exactly what they're missing.
Yeah.
The children who are a bit slower cognitively or who have more severe symptoms may need a reward system. They may need a token economy mm-hmm. where they receive a chit for good behavior or for being, you know, mm-hmm. in their desk or for mm-hmm. being hands on top of the desk or mm-hmm. book open on the right page. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, they can trade those tokens for a prize.
Oh.
And so we can externally motivate them at times to keep them on task and help them be successful. But the ideal would be, especially with the brighter ones, to teach them a self-regulating process. Mm-hmm. And when we are treating adults with this, again, we use a cognitive process to try to train them to be self-regulating, to remind themselves, to look at their planner 10 times a day,
mm-hmm.
to look at their watch frequently, mm-hmm. to make sure that they're not spending too much time cruising the internet during work.
And getting lost in it. Yeah. Yeah. So the tools, those cognitive behavioral tools you're talking about, it sounds like there's a lot of cases wherein that's sufficient. And the approach between child and adult is not that much different. It's just the topics. It's not about sitting in your desk. It's about focusing on what's in your day plan or what the task at hand is and that sort of thing.
When I work with children with ADHD, I actually work more with the parents and teach them to, because I can talk to a child an hour a week and it may stick or it may not. But if mm-hmm. I can motivate mom and dad to use those reminders,
yes,
to provide structure, consistency, and then to teach, what are you doing? What are you supposed to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
To ask the children leading questions so that the child needs can learn to ask mm-hmm. themselves the same questions mm-hmm. and learn to self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true in almost any childhood disorder. You, for effective treatment, you really are training the parents more than you're treating the child.
Yes.
Unless, of course, the child is, like in foster care, somehow separated from mm-hmm. family, mm-hmm. then you may spend exclusively your time with the child. Or if the mm-hmm. child's been badly abused, you may mm-hmm. spend more time with the child. But mm-hmm. in run-of-the-mill children's problems, you're probably going to spend more time with the parents than with the child.
So in more severe cases, then, you get into things that actually do hamper the ability of the child to be successful in school and be successful maybe even in their relationships with their family.
Well, there's an additional problem. Since this is a family problem,
yes.
It runs in families. Very mm-hmm. often you're going to find one or both parents who have the same problem.
Yeah.
Very often, most often, you'll probably find an absent father with the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
Very often, since males most often have this problem, and mm-hmm. then male children most often have this mm-hmm. problem, oftentimes you'll see an absent father. So the child has gone through a divorce or a sense of mm-hmm. abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they visit their father for parenting time, that time may not be very well organized. It mm-hmm. may not be very successful. Mm-hmm. So then you may wind up with poor role models, mm-hmm. or an inability to learn to respond to males appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
You might, some women grow up and become caretakers because of their mm-hmm. own childhood. And mm-hmm. so they may marry a succession of males with the same problem.
Yeah.
Because that gives them function and value mm-hmm. to always be rescuing somebody who mm-hmm. is bright and capable and means well and just needs a little management.
Yeah.
A little
which
rescuing.
Fits the ADHD right to a T.
Absolutely. In fact, oftentimes if you see a successful adult with ADHD, you're going to find his spouse or her spouse to be very organized and very nurturing mm-hmm. and keeping that person on track. Is it time to pay the bills? Is it time to get ready for this? Is it time to do that?
So without that partner, they wouldn't have gotten successful because they need that.
Very, very often there is someone who is structuring that person.
Mm-hmm.
They may have all the skills and talents you could ever ask for, mm-hmm. but they need that ego, as Freud would say, someone to organize and mm-hmm. be an executive function mm-hmm. for them.
Okay. Now, you mentioned some things in talking about kids with ADHD that the genesis of it or the beginnings of it, it's a biological, neurological thing that's occurring in the brain that we may not completely understand yet. But there's obviously some environmental factors that impact it or maybe bring it out. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. If a child is growing up in a secure environment with consistent parents, in a stable home where there's plenty to eat and the power is always on and that mm-hmm. sort of thing, the child learns, any child will learn, to be more calm and self-regulating in a stable environment. But if a child grows up in a chaotic environment, then how do you differentiate between what is learned mm-hmm. from chaos mm-hmm. and what is internal genetic chaos?
Yes.
So, yes, certainly there are other factors that can make it better or worse. And IQ certainly is a significant factor. If you're sitting in a classroom looking out the window and the teacher asks you a question, if you have an IQ of 120, you can probably answer it even if you weren't listening.
Yeah.
But if you have an IQ of 85, you're in trouble.
Then you're in trouble.
There's no way you can piece things together
and
look typical or look responsible at that point. So there are a lot of factors.
Well, that kid's going to get tagged. The kid with the 80-85 IQ that seems lost when he gets asked the question, he's going to get tagged as a kid with the problem. The kid with the 120 IQ may get tagged as a bright kid who we just need to challenge more.
Absolutely. A lot of times these kids are seen as being under-challenged, that they're just mm-hmm. bored in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And in fact,
Some of them are. Yeah.
There's mm-hmm. just no doubt that the classrooms are not the ideal situation for extremely bright, creative kids who get bored quickly. And these kids who have trouble academically and socially then oftentimes begin to do what they do best, which is to entertain.
Yes.
They misbehave, they get attention, they get revenge, they pick on other kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many times I've heard a teacher tell me, yeah, everybody likes Johnny when he's on the playground, but they don't want to be at his table in the classroom because he's a lot of fun when he's out there playing on the playground, but nothing gets done at his work table because he disrupts everybody.
Oh, boy. Well, so, yeah, there are this conflagration or this coming together of environmental and genetic, physiological issues can really bring some very pronounced kinds of problems out in kids, some of which can be treated with the cognitive behavioral things you're talking about and the self-training, self-talk kinds of things, assistance from parents who create a more stable environment or as stable environment as they can. But sometimes that's not all it takes.
Absolutely. The primary intervention, well, certainly, when a child is first being diagnosed responded to, behavioral interventions and cognitive interventions are the first line of defense. We try always mm-hmm. with the least risky intervention.
Yes.
If that doesn't work, then medication is the next line of defense. And research shows that medication and behavioral interventions are the ideal. But if you have just some or just one factor, the medication by itself is the best single intervention.
If you can do nothing else.
If you can do nothing else, the medication is quite effective.
Yes. But both is probably the ideal situation is where you've got both the cognitive behavioral treatment as well as the medical treatment.
The ideal is when parents recognize that their child has a neurological problem rather than a behavior problem, and they need to modify their parenting rather than just punish the child.
You're not a bad kid. You have this issue you have to deal with.
And then if we can identify the problem at school and the school can accommodate this disability, then the child has success both at home and at school. But if he's undiagnosed and is just treated as a bad boy or or a ditzy girl, then we have problems with comorbidity. Comorbid means you have two or more things going on at the same time. There's a high correlation between ADHD and math disabilities and reading disabilities. Almost two-thirds of the kids who are identified with ADHD also have a learning disability. So here you have a kid in school who's having trouble, maybe in math, maybe in reading, finds that very frustrating, and then they can't pay attention. And so they're doubly challenged.
Yes.
They get discouraged. They want to quit. They want to give up. They want to start drawing in the margins. They want to start pulling pigtails. They want to start daydreaming about what they're going to do when they get home or out on the playground. And it becomes a very vicious circle, and that's why we have a tremendous number of these kids dropping out of school. They have so much frustration, and if they're untreated, they have social. Everybody hates an ADHD kid, basically, in the classroom at least, because they're always in your face, saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, crossing boundaries, and so untreated. A lot of these kids in the past, before we really began to understand what was going on and had interventions, a lot of these people wound up in prison. They simply couldn't hold a job, turned to crime, turned to drugs to ameliorate their pain, and wound up committing crimes to feed their drug habits, and there was an overabundance of them in jail.
So you're talking about a serious downward spiral that just...
A tremendous social cost.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of lost productivity as well as the cost of intervening to try to keep these people out of trouble.
Well, it is a fascinating topic, and it's time for us to take our first break. So we will be back in just a couple of minutes to talk more with Dr. John Fagen of Andrews & Associates about ADHD. Remember, you can email us your questions at answers@andrewsinc.net, and you are listening to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered on Kanza Internet Radio.
Strange to you and me. But to his two-year-old son, who's interested in cars and colors, he makes perfect sense.
That's the sound cars make.
When you talk with your child, you build vocabulary, and learning starts long before school does. So follow their lead. Take simple everyday moments, like eating dinner or just watching cars go by, and turn them into learning moments.
Ooh, look, red car!
Yes, that is moving awfully fast.
Blue car!
Yes, the man in the red car is about to meet the man in the blue car. Get himself a pretty pink ticket.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews with Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. And we're taking your questions and talking about ADHD this morning with Dr. John Fagen, also of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. You can email us your questions at answers at AndrewsInc, that's AndrewsInc.net. Follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, or check us out on the Konza Internet Radio website at Konza Radio, that's K-O-N-Z-A, radio.org. Dr. Fagin, before the break, we were talking about ADHD and the potential for comorbidity, or the incidence of ADHD also being associated with other mental health issues.
Well, one of the problems is if you are constantly off task and getting corrected or reminded, especially if you're not diagnosed and you're being seen as a bad boy or a bad girl and you're being punished, it's very difficult to maintain a very happy little attitude. These children have difficulty building a positive self-esteem. They tend to get very anxious. What am I going to screw up next? Mm-hmm. Or very depressed. Look at all the mistakes I've made. Everybody hates me. I'm not worth nothing.
Yes.
And so there's certainly a lot of emotional issues that can spin off of the behavioral problems, the learning problems, the social problems. It can really snowball, and you can have a child come into your office that really looks horribly anxious or horribly depressed, and that's what you begin to treat. Mm-hmm. And then you wonder what caused that. You know, is it a family problem or is it a learning problem?
Mm-hmm.
Self-esteem forms before kindergarten. And so if the parents have been very positive and supportive and recognizing this child is different, but that's okay.
Yes.
Then the child may enter kindergarten with a very positive attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But if a child has been sort of a scapegoat in the family, sort of somebody to target because he's always misbehaving and that's a distraction from family systems problems, then he can wind up walking into kindergarten ready to fail.
Absolutely. Wow. And then there are mood disorders that can be associated with that.
Well, frequently anxiety and depression, one or both of them, are a comorbid problem, even in fairly early childhood, if it's mm-hmm. not a supportive family.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if a child has mild symptoms and is fairly bright and has a good family, it may not even be noticed until things become more complex. You know, in the early years of school, teachers are very supportive and very structured.
Yes.
Well, as a child ages and goes through the system, they are expected to be more independent,
mm-hmm.
and topics become more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times you'll see kids enter, they've gone through elementary school quite successfully.
Yes.
They get to middle school and fall apart.
Ah. Absolutely. Plus it's a much more chaotic environment. I mean, you're moving from class to class to class every hour. Every hour and a half, and yeah.
Then there's the whole puberty issue and the
yes.
style issue mm-hmm. and all mm-hmm. of that. So there's a lot of kids who don't get diagnosed until the seventh or eighth grade, or maybe not until high school.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the really bright ones don't get diagnosed until they get to KSU.
Yeah.
Or any other college.
Or ever.
I've seen here recently, I've seen a variety of young adults who did well in high school.
Yes.
Skated right through, mm-hmm. came from good families, and mm-hmm. maybe they had some athletic prowess or some other skills
mm-hmm.
that made them popular. And they get here, they're all on their own, there's nobody to remind them to do their homework, they get distracted, they mm-hmm. get confused, they mm-hmm. fall apart. Then guess where they wind up? Aggieville.
Yeah.
So, or in relationships that aren't good for them.
Mm-hmm. Or both.
Or both. Frequently.
Or relationships have come out of Aggieville.
But if we can get them diagnosed and get them to stop self-medicating and start
yes.
using medication appropriately, mm-hmm. start mm-hmm. using that planner,
mm-hmm.
start programming their phone with reminders to do this mm-hmm. and not do that,
mm-hmm.
we can get them back on track, perhaps even more successful than they've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
I met one young man a few years ago. It was at a job corps, as a matter of fact, when I was consulting out there. And he was obviously a bright young man, very creative, a delightful young man, but he just wasn't succeeding at all. I interviewed him and found out that he'd really never been very successful. There was such a disparity between what I could see as potential and mm-hmm. what I saw as production
mm-hmm.
that we tested him and found that he met criteria, and we medicated him. And he came in a couple of weeks later and he said, "I can read a page just once and remember what's on it. I used
wow.
to read the same page over and over and over, and I still couldn't remember at the end of the chapter what I'd read." He said, "I thought I was stupid. He said, I'm going to go to college.
Wow.
Just like that. Mm-hmm. One of the other little stories I like to tell is about a 9-year-old boy. His mother was a nurse, and she did not want him medicated. She was totally mm-hmm. against stimulant medication, but nothing else was working very mm-hmm. well. So she agreed to a trial, and he came back the next week, and he said, Dr. Fagen, I can get all my math done in class. I don't have to take it home. And he said, when I'd take it home, I'd be tired, and I'd be sitting at the kitchen table, and I couldn't remember the instructions, and I just couldn't hardly get it done, and I always got in trouble for not doing my homework because I was more interested in what was going on with the rest of the family. He said, now I can get it done in class, and I don't have all those problems.
Wow.
Another story I like to tell is a mother who brought her 5-year-old in about the 1st of August and said, I think my son has ADHD, and I would like to check for that diagnosis and see what we can do about it. And I frequently ask a question during the intake, why are we talking about this today? Why not 6 months ago? Why not six months from now? Why is it an issue right now? Mm-hmm. And she said, doctor, don't you get it? He's going to start school in 2 weeks.
Uh-huh. Let's fix it.
He's going to have to learn to sit still and learn to read. Uh-huh. And currently, he can't possibly do that.
Yeah.
And I said, well, have you talked to the pediatrician about this? She said, the pediatrician thinks I'm a lousy mother who just wants to make a zombie out of my kid so that I don't have to deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a little unkind.
Mm-hmm.
But in interviewing, certainly there were a number of other people in the child's genetic background who certainly should have been diagnosed if they weren't.
Yes.
That was my hometown, so I kind of knew some of the issues and actually had seen this boy's father grow up. Anyway, we did test the child, but during that initial interview, it was kind of interesting. They came in and sat down, and she asked him to sit on a chair. Well, that lasted about 2 seconds. The next thing you know, he's slumped down in the chair. Next thing, his head is hanging over one arm of the chair. His knees are hanging over the other. And then he slides out of the chair. Then he's under the chair. Then he's in the toy box. Then he's behind my desk. She hauls him back to his chair. He sits there for a second. Then he's climbing on her chair. And then he comes around behind my desk, and he opens the drawer, and he's going through everything. And I'm letting him do this because I want to see how many boundaries he will violate.
Yeah, yeah, just how far will he go.
How far will he go? And what is his agenda? Well, he was just incredibly curious. He was a bright child, mm-hmm. restless and curious. So we did write a letter to the pediatrician, and he was medicated. And I had her come back in a month or so, and she said, the teachers just love him. He's mm-hmm. a great kid, and he's mm-hmm. doing very, very well, mm-hmm. making good progress. And he sat on the chair in my office right mm-hmm. beside his mother as delightfully as any 5-year-old boy would. Not perfectly,
yeah.
but just as
But no
typical.
5-year-old boy would.
Right. He was typical at that point. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the mother was very grateful that she was going to have a successful child.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just some stories where we could see, significant symptoms that were readily identified mm-hmm. and easily treated.
Now, you mentioned this idea of testing a child. What kinds of procedures are involved in that kind of process?
I call it peeling the onion.
Uh-huh.
Basically, there's no inexpensive definitive test for ADD or mm-hmm. ADHD.
You can't draw a blood sample and say you've got it.
Nothing like that. So the first thing you do is get a pediatric workup or a medical workup to make sure you're not looking at diabetes or some thyroid problem mm-hmm. or some issue like that. The second thing you want to look at is school records. Mm-hmm. is this a learning disability? Is mm-hmm. this a hearing disability? Mm-hmm. Is this an information processing disability mm-hmm. that's strictly a cognitive process?
Mm-hmm.
If you can rule out all of those, then you give the Conner's scale, C-O-N-N-E-R-S, mm-hmm. the Conner's scales, which there are some short forms and some long forms, but basically you send some to the teachers and you send some to the parents.
It's like a questionnaire.
It's a questionnaire. Does your child do this a little, some, a lot, or mm-hmm. almost always?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a number of scales on this instrument, and it looks at, are they rebellious? Do mm-hmm. they have emotional issues? Do they have social issues?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they simply inattentive? Are they hyperactive? Mm-hmm. Or do they have all of it?
Mm-hmm.
And based on those percentiles, usually you look at anything over 90 to 98% percentile. And if they score that high and you rule out the rest of the thing, then the simplest thing is to try the stimulant medication. There are some other medications that are somewhat effective with some children, but the gold standard is an amphetamine or an amphetamine derivative, and such as Ritalin or Adderall.
Yes, and those are the two most popular right now. And can you talk a little bit about how that, I mean, we're talking about a kid who has hyperactivity, he's jumping all over the place, and you're giving him something that is essentially a stimulant that for anybody who didn't have ADHD would make them hyper. So how does that work?
Well, the problem with ADHD is that there are two areas of the brain that are under-functioning. One of them, it's a technical term, is the smaller basal ganglia, which is deep in the brain, and it's involved with routine behaviors, just maintaining a routine. The other area that's affected is the frontal lobe, and this is involved with planning, organizing, paying attention, controlling impulses, and most importantly, inhibiting responses that are inappropriate. So those areas of the brain just seem to be kind of sleepy. And that can be shown on brain scans that there is differential brain activity in those areas. And then you medicate them with a stimulant, and their brain function on the brain scan appears much more typical of other people in the same group. Dopamine seems to be the main neurotransmitter that seems to be, it's needed to modify that. Dopamine is involved in controlling emotions and reactions, concentrating, reasoning, coordinating. So if you have low levels of dopamine, you can have lots of problems.
Yeah, and that's the, makes you feel good when your brain is adequately supplied with dopamine.
I'm not sure there's much of like a, there's no high. I mean, if you take the medication appropriately, you don't get a buzz. Children typically don't like the medication. An interesting thing, one time a child said, or a young adult said, I don't like this. And I said, what's the problem? You're doing so much better. And he said, yeah, but life is so boring now.
I've slowed down to the point where.
My friends say I'm no fun anymore.
Interesting. Well, there is an issue, or at least I know there was an issue that was talked about in the media, say 10, 20 years ago, about sort of a rampant overdose or overdiagnosing of ADHD. And what's the thought among mental health professionals on that?
Well, it seems like every 5 to 10 years, there's a new diagnosis. There's a new buzzword, you know. It's bipolar, or it's ADHD, or it's sexual abuse, or it's PTSD. It just seems like it's a merry-go-round of a diagnosis, and then everybody's got it.
Yes.
And then we go on to something else. So certainly, I do believe that there were a lot of people who overdiagnosed and overtreated at one point. However, I think that you know, as soon as the professionals become aware of what's going on around them, I think they start to become much more cautious and self-regulating themselves. And medical doctors are just, a lot of times, even pediatricians won't diagnose and treat this on their own. They want a second opinion. And I do get a number of referrals from local pediatricians and medical doctors for children and for adults. They want a professional opinion. And sometimes then they will start the child or the adult on medication, but insist they follow up with a psychiatrist or or a nurse practitioner because they just don't want to have that as a primary diagnosis and a primary intervention. For some reason, the medical profession is just, I think they're frightened of people who are drug seeking inappropriately. And there's, you know, there is some risk involved with stimulants that, that they can get lost, they can get stolen.
And there is misuse. I mean, it's possible to misuse these medications.
There's a new stimulant on the market, relatively new. It's called Vyvanase. And it's formulated so that it doesn't act as an amphetamine until it goes through your stomach. With the typical amphetamines, the kids or young adults can crush them up and snort them like cocaine. But the Vyvanase, if you snort it, you get nothing. It has to go through the stomach juices to become the stimulant itself. And so that's helpful. There was another medication, a very attractive sounding medication called Strattera, that was considered to be the answer to this fear of abuse and addiction. Unfortunately, I found very few people who they may start on it and not mm-hmm. stay on it very long. It mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be very effective. I'm certainly not a physician or a pharmacist, but my understanding is that Strattera is related to the drugs like Prozac and Zoloft.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal theory, and it is just personal,
yes,
is that what they are treating is the emotional side effects of ADD or ADHD.
Oh, okay.
And so they give the medication and they say, look, it worked. But what you're treating is the comorbidity.
Yes.
And when the mood disorder goes away, the person typically then has more ability to self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you are moody, emotional, depressed, anxious, and ADD, and you take either one of them away, the other one is easier to conquer.
Sure.
So
sure.
I really think that's the mechanism that's happening. Some people get on it and do well with it, and I think that that's wonderful. But by and large, the stimulants are cheap and mm-hmm. safe. We've been mm-hmm. prescribing them for well over 30 years, mm-hmm. 40 years that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some problems with heart problems and other medical crises, but the percentage of those are very, very low. When they hit the newspaper, they sound real serious, mm-hmm. but the percentage is really, really low, and any medication has that possibility.
Yeah, so they're relatively safe.
I've heard it said it's the safest medication we give to kids.
Wow.
And ADHD is probably the most commonly diagnosed health problem with children in America today.
Wow. Well, it is time for us to take our second break. We want to come back after the break. We've got a couple of questions that are specifically related to ADD and ADHD and get a little bit more into the incidence of it with adults and dealing with it as adults. So meanwhile, we want you to listen to a couple of things here and let you know that you can send us your questions at answers@andrewsinc.net. That's answers@andrewsinc.net. You are listening to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered on Kanza Internet Radio.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Attention parents of young children.
The following is a partial list of things that are probably happening in your backseat that you are completely unaware of.
A food item is probably being stuffed into a crack.
A strange sticky substance is being spread everywhere.
Deep, sustained, nasal exploration.
Someone is probably making faces.
Hitting
back.
The cleaning of muddy shoes.
Farting!
Something is probably spilling.
Gum is lodging in hair.
And your kids are probably riding car seats that are being used incorrectly. In fact, 3 out of 4 kids are not as safe as they should be. But the latch system is in most cars and makes it easier to get it right.
Just attach the top tether and the lower anchors. The ones down near the old sandwich and the melted down crayons.
Anchor, tether, latch. The next generation of child safety.
A message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
And welcome back to Andrew's Answers. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews with Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. Here talking with Dr. John Fagen, also of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan. And Dr. Fagen, we've been talking about ADD and ADHD, but you were about to talk about some issues that are related to, or what happens if it's not properly treated. What can the results be there?
Well, imagine, if you will, you're going through junior high and high school and you're not successful, you're always getting in trouble, and you find things outside of the school much more interesting because they're not so challenging. You know, in an unstructured environment where people can kind of come and go as they please, or in a class such as PE or art, one of these kids may do very, very well because they have more flexibility. It's when you line them all up in desks all in a row and say, everybody do exactly the same mm-hmm. thing at the same time, that it's a problem. And they stand out like a sore thumb, mm-hmm. and they feel a sense of failure. And so they start looking for relief. Mm-hmm. And they want to run away, they want to drop out, or they want to get interested in the opposite gender, or they want to start drinking.
Yeah.
Smoking weed. Mm-hmm. Smoking weed seems to be almost a panacea for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
They love the effect of the marijuana for some
calming
reason.
And
very calming, and it helps them sort of focus in some mm-hmm. way. And cocaine, mm-hmm. one of the questions I ask of adults is, have you ever sampled someone else's Adderall, or have you ever used any stimulant such mm-hmm. as cocaine?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them will say, oh yeah, and it had a completely different effect on me than it did on my friends.
Yeah.
And that's a giveaway.
Okay.
That it's helping them. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that research has shown is that comparison groups of young men who were identified and treated versus those who were not is that boys who were treated had a less likelihood of abusing alcohol and drugs as they went on through adolescence and adulthood. They learned a legitimate way to be medicated and resolve their problems to some degree, as opposed to the untreated ones who just self-medicated to the point of self-sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a lot of parents who have a lot of fear of stimulants because they can be abused and they are addictive if you abuse them. As mm-hmm. long as you stick to the recommended dose.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the nice things about a stimulant is that it's a PRN medication. You don't have to take it on weekends unless you're going to church or a wedding or a funeral.
Okay.
Or you're going to take a long car drive.
Just not get up every morning and take your pill. It's
you can stay off all summer. If you can run around the backyard and play all summer, you don't need this medication. Mm-hmm. It's when you sit down, when you have to sit down in a row and do the same thing at the same mm-hmm. time, keep your hands to yourself and keep your mouth shut,
mm-hmm.
that's when you need it.
Yeah. And there's not a problem with taking it for a week and then being off of it for a
Absolutely
week.
Absolutely none, mm-hmm. from what I've been told.
Yes.
So you can reduce that issue of dependency or addiction mm-hmm. and teach the child on weekends. You're going to learn how to self-regulate mm-hmm. over the summer. I'm not mm-hmm. going to give you this medication.
Mm-hmm.
You need to practice.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing is that when you approach the problem appropriately, you're less likely to get any sort of abuse of alcohol and drugs in high school and college. And so that opens the door to much more success. I can't say often enough how upsetting it is to fail at everything you do.
Mm-hmm.
And to be rejected by every person you dated because you blurted out the wrong thing at the wrong time, or you mm-hmm. misread their cues and you took it further than they wanted to mm-hmm. go, and you had good intentions and you thought you were doing okay, and mm-hmm. then it's a slap in the face every time.
Yeah.
Because you just weren't paying attention. We had talked a little bit about the epidemiology or the difference in different cultures, and there's something called the hunter versus farmer theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that any given culture, you may find some people who are very content to stay in one place and farm the same farm for generations after generations.
Mm-hmm.
And they stay very focused on just one thing.
Yes.
And there are other people who couldn't possibly stand to mm-hmm. do that. And so they tend to be hunter-gatherers. And mm-hmm. this is, you know, over time. And they're out looking for things. And they love the novelty. And they love the challenge. And mm-hmm. they love the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much more likely to actually spot the game
mm-hmm.
or hear the game because they are so distractible.
Yes.
So instead of paying attention to one thing, they may hear that mm-hmm. snort or that stomp of a
uh-huh.
foot. Whereas the farmer type, the more sedate and focused mm-hmm. on one thing type, mm-hmm. may walk through a forest and never see the game.
Ah, okay.
So yeah. there's that theory.
So one of the advantages to having ADHD. Yeah.
And if I had a patrol in the military in a hostile environment, I would want to have one of these people because they're going to mm-hmm. hear, they're going to notice the slightest movement,
mm-hmm.
the rustling of the leaves. They're going to mm-hmm. go, "What was that?"
Uh-huh.
As long as they can do it quietly.
If they don't give you away.
If they blurt it out, yeah, then you're all in trouble.
Uh-huh.
There's another theory that there's certainly more ADHD identified in the United States than any other country.
Okay.
And one of the theories is that, again, people who are accustomed to living in small villages and small kingdoms in Europe stayed there. They were you know, the farmer type, or the people who are not disabled were content to be ruled by an aristocracy or a kingship and just stayed there. But the restless ones couldn't tolerate the structure, the routine. They needed novelty. They needed excitement. And so they migrated.
Oh.
And then you'll see that across the United States, there's a lower incidence on the East Coast and it spreads to the West. Because as soon as the immigrants got here, the ones without ADHD settled right down. The ones who are restless and hyperactive and curious kept moving west for more challenge and more novelty. And so you see a spreading to the western part of the United States.
Medium incidence here in the middle of the country and then off the charts on the West Coast.
Well, it's not quite that extreme, but there are differences. And part of it may just be different cultures, how we accept behavior and misbehavior.
Yes.
Some cultures, as I alluded to before, have totally different expectations of kids. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, if you think of the Midwest and the northern states, there may be a lot more structure in families than there are on the coast or in the southern part of the United States. They just expect more of their kids, and they notice any variation from the expectation.
And want to do something about it.
And that's why there's more. The CDC tracks the number of kids who are actually diagnosed, and they track the number that are actually medicated. And certainly the upper Midwest, on up and to the Northwest, there's more diagnoses and more interventions.
Wow.
And
interesting.
And that may be cultural. It may be genetic.
Yes. And you mentioned, too, that this is a persistent issue. This is not something you have as a child and then magically goes away. You may learn to deal with it successfully, and you may not need medication for all of your life, but it is not something that just disappears.
No, if you have it as a child, you have it as an adult.
And oftentimes, then, it might actually not be diagnosed as a child. And our question here that we have is, what signs that ADHD might be an issue for an adult should an adult look for? And if undiagnosed before adulthood, has he simply managed it, or can it develop over time? And how will he know to look into this or bring it to his physician's attention for exploring the possibility?
A problem isn't a problem until it interferes in your life. You may have ADD or ADHD as an adult, and it may not affect you to that degree because you may have a mild case of it, or you may have learned to self-regulate, and you may have a supportive spouse and environment, or an employer who likes your creativity, who likes your spontaneity, and it may not become a problem at all. You may have the diagnosis without the problem. It's a problem when it becomes a problem. It's kind of like having a beer or two. If it doesn't become a problem, it's not a problem. If it interferes with your lifestyle, it's a problem. If it's one beer a year and it interferes with your life, it's a problem. And the same is true with this. If you're finding yourself disorganized, if you're finding yourself forgetting things, if you're finding yourself worrying about getting things done, having trouble starting a job, having trouble finishing a job, a lot of anxiety and depression about others' responses to you. If you just can't seem to stay organized, that's probably the biggest issue that adults come in with and say, I work hard, I try hard, I'm motivated, I care, and I can't seem to get anything done. I can't stay on task. I wind up leapfrogging. There's an interesting email going around about my Saturday. You know, I started out to do this, and then I saw that wasn't done, so I turned and started on that job, and then I noticed this wasn't done. And at the end of the day, I started 20 jobs and didn't finish a one of them. And now my house is a worse wreck than it was this morning because I have all these unfinished jobs. And that's probably a pretty good analogy or description of adult ADHD. The inability to get things done in an organized way if you're capable of doing it and you're motivated to do it and you just can't get it done.
Very good. Well, we have another question here. Sally writes in and says, I am a college student and I study. I feel like I'm understanding the material. Then I take a test and never do well. I want my grades to reflect all the time I spend studying. Is that possible for me?
If this person is actually studying, I would expect them to do reasonably well on a test, as long as the test is not conducted in a really chaotic environment. It's the everyday interference where you're going to see an adult with ADD or ADHD getting in trouble. It's that day in and day out. Actually, the challenge of a test can motivate. When you have a deadline and you're approaching the deadline, most ADD and ADHD people can pull themselves together under the pressure of the external threat and actually do the studying at the last minute.
That's a stimulant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. And that motivates and mobilizes all those internal resources. And those people generally are very sloppy with their homework and their everyday practices, and then pull it out like a miracle at the end of the semester.
Because they have that ability.
Yes.
So one of the things is, then somebody might think that they have ADHD as an adult because of issues like having trouble with tests, but it might actually be something else.
Absolutely. It could be a variety of things that mimic ADD or ADHD. If they have poor self-esteem, if they're anxious, if they have any kind of a health problem that could make it difficult for them to have energy, if they have a sleep disorder of any kind. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people with minor sleep disorders, minor sleep apnea, that just don't get enough oxygen all night long. And then the next morning they're sleepy and dopey. Mm-hmm. They often run to sweets to try to stimulate them, sweets and coffee to try to stimulate themselves, to keep themselves awake. So you look at what they're eating, you look at what they're sleep, how they're sleeping, you look at how much they're taking in with alcohol or any other drugs. Just because somebody has the symptoms as an adult, not necessarily. The most important thing in diagnosing an adult is you look at their childhood, because if they didn't have it as a child, they don't have it as an adult. But if they're extremely bright, they may have had it as a child and never got diagnosed.
But you still should be able to find evidence of it from their report to you about how things were when they were children.
What I look for, and most parents save grade cards, so what I look for is grade cards, not the grades, but the teacher comments.
Yes.
Needs to get organized, needs to turn things in on time, needs to organize his desk, needs to keep his hands to himself. These kids are typically people pleasers, unless they're really, really discouraged, because they have a disability. And so they figure out how to get adults to compensate and to take care of them and to excuse them. And that's one of the ways you diagnose. If somebody looks like they're really trying hard and you want to help them, they're much more likely to be ADHD. If they're misbehaving and you're irritated with them, they probably don't have it. They probably have a rebellion problem.
Okay.
A revenge problem.
So you can actually use your own gut as the therapist or this person doing the diagnosing to inform your decision about whether or not this person has ADHD.
A therapist's gut is the most important tool they own.
Very good. Very good. Well, that's a great thing to mention, and also this fact, or the idea that, you know, test anxiety isn't ADHD. And some people have test anxiety, and that doesn't necessarily mean they have ADHD.
You can have both.
Yes. And you might have had ADHD that then results in test anxiety because you can never do well. But,
So excellent point.
Differentiating between those different kinds of things that can be problems for an adult, because given somebody who simply had test anxiety, a stimulant to treat what you think is ADHD when really that's not what's going on isn't going to work for them or help them at all.
Make it worse. You know, if somebody has test anxiety, you look at their everyday behavior in class versus their test behavior.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's the differentiation.
Well, very good. We have come to the end of our program today, and I want to thank Dr. John Fagen of Andrews and Associates here in Manhattan, Kansas. Dr. Fagen, you want to give a phone number and how they can contact you if they have other questions or want to talk about this?
Well, the office phone number is 539-5455. You can certainly call. We can have a brief phone conversation, or you can come in and we can screen the situation. No commitment. We can just take a brief look at what is likely going on and make a decision whether to continue the assessment or not.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Fagen. That's at 785-539-5455. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, and you have been listening to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered, right here on Kanza Internet Radio.
You are listening to Konza Internet Radio at www.konzaradio.org. We would like to thank the Lawrence, Kansas musical group, Mammoth Life, for the music used during the previous programming.